Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the May board meeting of the ISB. We are going to start off today with a discussion of a set of papers on goodwill and impairment. And for some introductory words, I give the floor to Tim.
Thanks, Hans, and good morning, everyone. So today we're going to discuss the remainder of the feedback on the board's discussion paper, Business Combinations, Disclosures, Goodwill and Impairment, being the effectiveness of the impairment test, the reintroduction of amortization, simplifying the impairment test, and the other topics in the discussion paper. And this feedback summarised in Agenda Papers 18B to 18E. We will also discuss a summary of academic evidence related to the topics in the discussion paper. That's covered in Agenda Paper 18F. And we plan to go through each of the papers 18B to 18F in turn and ask board members if you have any questions or comments on the content of those papers, paper by paper. Agenda Paper 18A is simply a copy of the same paper we provided to you in March, and so we have no questions for the board on that paper. And we have another session on goodwill and impairment tomorrow, and at that session we will discuss the plan for redeliberating the goodwill and impairment project, and that's covered in Agenda Paper 18G. So to start with, we'll start with Agenda Paper 18B, which is on the effectiveness of the impairment test. And the paper's unchanged from the equivalent paper for the April board meeting, other than a few minor editorial changes. And the board's preliminary view was that it's not feasible to design a different impairment test that's significantly more effective at recognising impairment losses on goodwill at a reasonable cost. And in summary, most respondents agreed with this preliminary view, and most agreed with the main reasons for the concerns about the timeliness of impairment losses that were identified by the board: shielding and too optimistic cash flows. Some respondents disagreed with the board and suggested ways to improve the impairment test, and these suggestions are described in paragraphs 37 to 53. And many respondents, although agreeing it's not feasible to design a different impairment test, did suggest ways that the board could improve the application of the impairment test in IS 36. And these suggestions are described in paragraphs 55 to 67. Typically, the suggestions to reduce too optimistic cash flows looked at ways to address the assumptions used in the impairment test or provide additional disclosure requirements, and suggestions to help reduce shielding related to providing guidance on how to identify cash generating units and allocate goodwill to those units. So I'd like to open it up now to board members to discuss this feedback and whether board members have any questions or comments on the feedback.
Okay, we open the floor. Who wants to be first? Mary.
Thanks, Hans. Thanks, Tim. Tim, I have a question about one suggestion to just ask you to maybe comment a bit further about why the staff thinks it's not worth pursuing. To be clear, I think, first of all, we have to be really careful that we don't have scope creep and this becomes a significant project on IS 36 itself, as well as looking at issues around goodwill. So I'm starting out by saying one of the things that I think would argue against what I'm about to ask you. If you look at paragraph 64, the one suggestion that struck me as perhaps worth pursuing is a bit more granularity, whether we could do anything to push for a bit more guidance, a bit more granularity about how you allocate goodwill to CGUs. Could you just maybe give me a bit more about your thinking about why not to pursue that? And specifically, you know, allocating, because it's allocating goodwill to CGUs, it seems to be more squarely in the focus of this project than a generalized 36 project.
Yeah, I mean, the board did consider this as part of, you know, possible simplifications when we were developing the discussion paper, and I think the general conclusion was it was difficult to provide guidance that would be applicable to all entities or to the majority of entities, given that entities are organised in different ways, organise their business units, their cash generating units in different ways. So there was some debate about whether the board could provide guidance that would be relevant to the majority of entities. I mean, just to clarify in terms of we haven't, I mean, these papers are presenting the feedback, and so as staff, we are in the midst of thinking about these suggestions and in the midst of thinking about what the staff would recommend the board might want to re-deliberate, and that will come further in the re-deliberations paper. And so something like this, and you know, certainly allocating goodwill to CGUs and the level it's allocated at is quite a strong piece of feedback in terms of respondents thinking, actually, if there are some things that the board could do to encourage entities not to allocate or default almost to the mm-hmm. operating segment level, that might be useful. And just on your comment on, oh, sorry, Mary, carry on.
No, I was just going to say paragraph 66, I should have said 66 rather than 64. And thanks for the reminder about the stage we're at and that it's just reporting feedback. But I really was looking at it less in the context of, is there a potential simplification? And actually more in the context of, is there a potential improvement in effectiveness? And those two sometimes may be in tension with each other. So that, putting my comment a different way, Of all the feedback that you're reporting in this paper, that is the one that to me kind of stood out as maybe being worth pursuing a bit further. And the others, I think they are all things that we had thought through, and you know, people are kind of coming on the journey with us about the pros and cons. And I didn't have a sense of pursuing the other one. So is that maybe a more helpful way to phrase that paragraph 66 comment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. And on the potential for scope creep that you mentioned, I think that is a fair comment, and I think that is an important thing for the staff and for the board to keep in mind, given that this isn't a full review of IS 36. That said, you know, two key pieces of feedback that the board's looking at is whether the impairment, the cost and complexity of the impairment test, and also the timeliness of impairment losses on goodwill, and a theme throughout this project since its sort of inception, when it came out of the PIR, was whether the impairment test could be improved. So, to your point, if there are items here that we feel that could improve the effectiveness of the impairment test, I think that is definitely within the board's gift to consider. And I wouldn't necessarily see that as scope creep, but I think your overall comment that we do need to keep that in mind, I think is a fair comment for both the staff and for the board as well.
Okay, thank you, Tim. Jen Chow.
Thank you, Hans. Just, I think, several comments or questions. Firstly, that I think the paper mentioned that it seemed that some stakeholders said that, particularly in Europe, you know, impairment-only model in recent years, you know, worked effectively. For example, one stakeholder mentioned in UK recently, it seems to work effectively. And some stakeholders in Europe said that actually in recent years, for example, during the pandemic, it seemed that impairment-only model didn't work very well. So I think because the evidence from practice, particularly from Europe, I think it should be very useful for us. So I just wondering, maybe we can double check what's the evidence behind those arguments. For example, the UK case, recently, this one consultant said that it is working as intended. I'm wondering whether because of Carillion Club's case, you know, in 2018, and afterwards maybe the enforcement of impairment test enhanced, and then it will bring the impairment loss model worked very well or better than before. But this is just the one question. I'm a little bit curious because the evidence seems different from practice. Secondly, I think there are a lot of suggestions how to improve the existing impairment test model of IS 36. I think it's worthwhile, both from a conceptual basis, also from the what kind of model we would like to develop. Conceptually, particularly in relation to the level of the goodwill should be allocated to CGU, I think some argument is very useful. For example, we should look at currently the lowest level of the CGU only rely on to the internal management system, and whether this discipline is enough. And the high level is the segment reporting. I think we can also think about that, particularly with regard to the alternative, different impairment test model. Different stakeholders mentioned a different project for approach. For example, headroom approach, implied goodwill approach, or direct value approach. Because when I look at, I think maybe in the future, if it's possible, maybe particularly in relation to the implied goodwill and the direct value approach, if we can develop some kind of example to compare different approach and advantage and disadvantage, may be helpful. Because when I look at the one of the approach, for example, direct value approach, supposed by the IVSC, but that approach actually depends on the CGU should be the same as the CGU identified at the acquisition date. Subsequently, there are no change, it seems that. And secondly, it also depends on the fair value of the CGU. So whether it's easy to assess or value the the fair value of the to measure the fair value of the CGU, so I think we should also look at those the feasibility of those models, but I think those different impairment approach, I think may be helpful for us to look at whether there are any room to improve the impairment test model. Another thing I think some people suggest to improve the assumption used in the impairment test, in my understanding, they are trying to suggest to actually to add some discipline on the assumption used in impairment test. I think those suggestions actually are very useful and also suggest some additional disclosure requirement. And I think also seems very useful. Not only add disclosure relation to the subsequent, performance or objective of business combination, but also in relation to the impairment test. So, yeah, I think there are a lot of good suggestions in place. Maybe in the future, if we look at how to improve the effective of impairment test, not test, I think we can think about those suggestions. We are going to also look at the one of the objective that is improve the effectiveness of impairment test. Thank you.
Thank you, Zhenqiao. Zach.
Thanks, Hans, and thanks to the staff for another great paper. I think looking through, I shared the view that there are a number of different recommendations for ways we could design the impairment test. I think they're probably worth still looking into. But none struck me as clearly an improvement that we could make. that wouldn't require a great deal of work. So I think we should continue looking at those. In contrast to Mary, though, the one thing that struck me the most was actually in paragraph 61 with some disclosure, surprisingly, which is one of the core problems that stakeholders have identified with the impairment test is that it's very difficult for the auditors to assess the reasonableness of some of the operating assumptions because they're not experts in the field and the operations of the field. And 61A in particular really struck me as an interesting concept to bring some of those experts into the field, not in a direct way in terms of auditing the assumptions, but in at least demonstrating the ways in which management is doing their cash flow estimates and whether those have been successful estimates in the past, where if you can really assess how accurate those assessments have been in the past, users and stakeholders can start generating their own views of the value of the goodwill. So I would definitely hope that all the suggestions in 61, but in particular that one, I think would be worth a further look in terms of bringing some sunlight into what the assumptions have been and how accurate the forecasts have been to really get at this problem of delaying impairments and those not happening quickly enough.
Interesting. Rika?
Thank you, Hans. First of all, thank you for staff for a thorough analysis of feedback we receive and the excellent paper. And then, so I have a comment about probably one thing. I see the room for improvement in the both impairment test, also the content of disclosure required in the IS-36. So, I think that if we make a small improvement in the impairment test, including the determination of the level of CGU or a group of CGU, at the same time, I want to see how that affects the enhancement of the content of the disclosure. So I want to see, improvement assessment together between the test itself and the related disclosure. But at the same time, I think we also proposed other disclosure in the DP. So the IS-36 disclosure enhancement should be considered together with the other proposed disclosure in DP that will make the related disclosure providing more useful and more efficient and effective way for the management to consider the goodwill. Thank you.
Thank you, Rika. Sue?
Thanks, Hans. Interesting paper. Thanks, guys. With lots of information. It's quite a dense paper. I just wanted to make a couple of observations on some things that just struck me as I was reading it. Firstly, I think that this paper in a couple of places highlights the sort of challenge we've got with people having sort of valid perceptions, but they sort of say, you know, it feels to me that impairment is, you know, on a timely basis or not, and we just always have to be, I think, disciplined in making sure there's evidence behind some of those comments. So that's just a general observation. But I wanted to make a couple of comments on some of the suggestions on the effectiveness and also on the disclosures. What really struck me reading this paper was the difficult path we would have treading between trying to look at ways at improving the effectiveness of tests without making things even more costly and difficult for preparers, because we started off with those sorts of two messages that we're constantly being trying to balance those. And I guess just to highlight that there's a few, you know, interesting ideas in here that might indeed enable a more granular assessment and a more sophisticated way of perhaps trying to assess the value of goodwill and to use that as a basis for impairment. But I wonder how complicated and costly they might be on the flip side. So getting that balance right. And a couple of examples just to illustrate my point, the suggestion that one thing that could be introduced would be looking at the fair value of a CGU at the time of the acquisition versus the fair value of the CGU at the date of the impairment test, and the idea of sort of being more specific about requiring multiple scenarios to be included in an analysis and including weighting and things like that. I mean, I think there's some interesting ideas conceptually, but, you know, obviously there's cost and complexity considerations that go with all of those things. So I guess just flagging that we're going to have to constantly, I think, keep that balance in mind. On the disclosure front, there's also some interesting ideas in here, and unsurprisingly, it'd be unsurprising for you to hear that I liked the comment in the last paragraph in the paper with the idea of linking the impairment indicators to the disclosures that we've proposed to do with the success of acquisitions. I liked that. But a couple of other observations on the disclosures. One is that I worry a little bit that some of the disclosures that are being suggested are things that I would have thought we should perhaps already be getting information on. So I worry about sort of application and compliance. And one example was the suggestion that there be this close call disclosures that's in 61C of the paper, because we do have general requirements to disclose judgments that are, you know, significant judgments made that could affect carrying values. I can't remember the exact words, but in IAS 1. And I always worry that the more that we have specifics, the more we undermine some of those general disclosure requirements we've got. So just to keep an eye on that. And the other one I wanted to just flag, unfortunately, sorry, Zach, given that you just expressed your interest in it, is 61A. And it's not that I don't think that there could be some usefulness in using this as a mechanism to sort of put the spotlight on the quality of the analysis that's undergone, some of the work that's undertaken behind the estimates that are used for goodwill calculations. And I completely respect that sort of intent. But I do worry a little bit about the fact that we already have a concern from preparers about being sort of second-guessed when they thought they were doing a good job. And this was actually highlighted to me in a different context in a meeting I was in last week on IFRS 9, my favourite standard, on the ECL requirements. And somebody said to me, what you require us to do is really unfair because you expect us to have a crystal ball and to know what our expected what losses we're going to suffer. And I reacted quite badly to that, as you might expect, because we don't expect people to have a crystal ball. All we're asking people to do is to come up with the estimate they have as at the reporting date, that as at that point in time, based on what they know at that time, is the best job they can do. So you can have situations where, with the best will in the world and the best information they've got available, management really has come up with numbers that they think at the reporting date was a really, you know, solid, for want of a better word, basis for this impairment testing. But things change. And I always worry a little bit with backtesting disclosures that, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, you know, you can be criticised for the quality of your judgments when actually, you know, all through this COVID crisis, we've been saying to people, we know you don't know for sure what's going to happen. You can only do what you've got you can do. You can only, you know, do a good job of explaining your assumptions. But we know that you can't guarantee that this is what's going to unfold. And I just think that if we're going to explore something along the lines that's in 61A, we just need to be careful of that sort of second guessing and the hindsight, and, you know, the benefit of, you know, hindsight coming in being used to kick management, when in fact at the time they made the estimates, it was a valid basis of estimation. And so just to flag that sort of other perspective.
But Sue, you could equally criticize our proposed disclosures, because they are also about expectations of the future, and then asking management to tell us how they are in fact doing. And that could also result in the criticism of being second guessed. Well, I actually liked Zach's interest in this, because it seems to me that these backtesting disclosures, it's not costly to do, because you have to do those projections anyway. And it might be a more neutral way of asking a company to disclose how the subsequent performance is relative to earlier expectations, and you don't necessarily have to give a lot of commercially sensitive information. You just show your original projections and you show how it has turned out to be, and then you explain it or not.
Yeah, and
it could also lead to some more discipline around over-optimism. So that's why I thought...
I was trying to be nuanced in what I said. I don't disagree with the idea here. I think we just have to be careful that we have enough ability and for people to explain why there may be valid reasons for why something has changed. Yeah. So it's not, if there's a gap, you know, slap over the wrist, you're wrong and you're bad. You know, things do change. And that's all that I want. I just want there to be balance between not creating this idea that wherever there's a gap, it's, you know, you did a bad job, you were wrong, you lied. It's rather, okay, let's try and find disclosures which enable you both to understand what's changed. And it's hard to unpick those two things. That's my only point.
Yeah. Bruce.
Thanks very much, Hansen, and thanks to the staff for the paper. Interestingly, my first comment was exactly on the point the two of you have been debating. My concern was very much around we've got to be careful not to make preparers scared of applying judgment. And I guess the thing that worries me at the moment is when I look at everything we're doing around the disclosures and back testing and all this kind of thing, my worry is that we get to that stage where as a preparer, I do make a best guess of what I've done. But the problem is that then when things don't go to plan, and the reality is, I mean, speak to a lot of preparers, these things never go to plan, you know, exactly as you want. It just looks negative for them. So I just get concerned that there's going to be that backlash that, well, you haven't achieved that. So I guess the warning I was going to give very much was the same one. Just be very, very conscious that we don't scare people from applying judgment. The other thing I was going to comment on was also the cost issue. I guess when it comes both to the testing and the disclosures, I do get worried that we've just got to be careful it doesn't get to a stage where we're over-engineering amendments to this. If I take a look at the impairment model, and I, as I always admit, I'm not a big fan of the impairment model, but if we go down the route of keeping with an impairment model on this, the big challenge to me is that I'm not convinced we can get this a lot better. It does work. It works in an imperfect way, if you know what I'm saying. What I mean is we're not going to get rid of the over-optimism of management, because at the end of the day, that's why you do a business combination. You're optimistic this is going to achieve things. And there's always going to be a degree of things like shielding, because this is an estimate of what we think and how the CGUs are going to play out. And I just get worried that we're going to get to a stage where we're forcing people into over-engineering this in a bit of a false way, to putting too much into it. So I would echo the comment. I would be very careful about this creeping into a massive relook at IS36 and the impairment model. Do I think we can simplify it a bit? I know we can discuss that later. If that's the route we go, yes, I think there's some simplification. But I think if our task is not to turn this into a simple test, and the same way, I don't think it's a task we've turned into a foolproof test. At the end of the day, there are limitations to having this type of impairment test, and I think that's not going to go away. The other thing, just as far as the disclosures go, I do think that, and I like the idea of saying we need to be quite holistic about the disclosures we're requiring and kind of the looking forward as well as what we're doing in this. So I think just when we're looking at the different parts of the project, just to be careful we don't look at what we're doing with the impairment test and the disclosure separately. I think these two things need to talk to each other. Just seeing the off the head. No, I guess that, I mean, just yeah. I just put you, as I said, there are challenges in the model, but I think at the end of the day, it's pretty good for what it is, and just to be careful, we don't do too much on that.
Okay, thank you, Bruce. Zach, you wanted to come back in.
I think Tadao was first.
Yeah, but you can react.
Just real quickly, I hear the point on wanting to avoid some management criticism. I do go back to one of the core ideas of the exposure document, which was management accountability. And I think anytime you have accountability, you open people up to criticism. I probably am most familiar, I'm certainly most familiar with equity investor standpoint, and I think it's useful for all stakeholders to remember what you call an equity investor who's right 55% of the time. you call him a genius. And that's something that we should keep in mind. I think there's this view that, you know, there's going to be immediate criticism when you miss a forecast. That's not been my experience with most investors. They understand things don't always go to plan, but when you see a pattern of things not going to plan, that begins to enter into your judgment and your assessment of the management team. And in my mind, that's what accountability is. So I just wanted to come back in quickly with that.
Okay, thank you, Zach. Tadeo.
Thank you, Hans. When we talk about this question of over-optimism, I like the answer that usually we say that most of this should be addressed or dealt with auditors and regulators. It's not something to be included in the standard. What we can do in these standards is just to be sure that the information is available for users, readers, and stakeholders in general make a decision. Just to remind that a very good action that was taken a few years ago was the format of the auditor report, where the auditors could give a more a flavor about the optimism of the assumptions and etc. And if you just look at, and I was in this field some years ago, I can tell you that management became much more careful when they are disclosing their assumptions, when they know that, for example, in case they are optimist in relation to an assumption, this probably will be one of the key auditing matters, and there will be some insight information in the auditor report. I think this is a very good way of moving, especially in relation to the over-optimism. Definitely, this is a much more regulatory and auditors issue than the standard setting issue. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Tadeo. Rika?
Yeah, thank you. About paragraph 61A, I think the naming of bad testing disclosure sounds really a little bit offensive, but I think the management is always required to explain and disclose the changes in the estimate and assumption. So in that way, I just wondering if our future proposal to encourage the management to consider and analyze more thoroughly about their judgment, and especially changes in the judgment from the previous period to the current year. I think in that way, we might be able to improve our requirement in this context. Thank
yeah,
you.
Certainly we should avoid the term backtesting. Yes. I can understand. Martin?
Yes, thanks, Hans. Also on this over-optimism. I don't think it is really a problem, because what happens in companies? It is not that management sitting there and say, what is the forecast of our cash flows for the next 5 to 10 years? It is different, because management is doing an ambitious plan and setting targets for the company, and this targets and plan should be ambitious. Because if they are not ambitious, I think equity investors will say you don't have an ambitious forecast plan for your company. If it is not ambitious, then the supervisory board or board of directors will say, okay, you have to come up with a more ambitious plan. And that is, I think, why it is over-optimism, because, okay, it is always plans should be ambitions. And then to say, okay, it kind of, if they don't meet it, it is a kind of failure. I don't know if that is really the right thing. And what we are doing now is to, I think there is always, and people have also commented on that in the feedback, saying there is always this over-optimism, because plans should be optimistic. Because otherwise, I think management has done a wrong job if they say, okay, it is a kind of, we should stay straight and not in looking for increased growth and so on and so forth. But then to, in an impairment test, then to give them a kind of disclosure if they have achieved that, what are the reasons, I think that is more a thing maybe we should consider in management reporting, in our practice statement is, okay, what is your plan? How do you want to achieve that? If you don't achieve, have achieved it, what is it based on MDNA? What were the reasons for that? But I don't know if we should go so far in an impairment testing, and if we're discussing effectiveness of impairment tests, that companies have to then to disclose, okay, scenarios and backtesting and say why they have not achieved that. I think that is, and that is what Bruce said. I think that is not a perfect thing what we are doing. But we're trying now to make it perfect, and then with disclosure, then that investors can maybe draw their own conclusions. I agree to that. But that should be done by other means. If a kind of investors want to know, okay, if management is good in achieving plans, that is not via an impairment testing. That is, I think, we have different things with this management reporting and other things, or MDNA stuff. It is not kind of through disclosures of an impairment test of goodwill. That is what I think. We're overdoing that then, if we're requiring that.
Well, I see all those arguments. I understand them. But I think the same arguments are valid for our original proposals about the disclosure about the subsequent performance of an acquisition. Because that's also a sort of a backtesting of the original expectation.
Yes, and we have received feedback on that.
Yeah, okay. Well, so if that is a serious concern, then we have to, you know, think more seriously about the whole proposal. Tom?
Just one small distinction on the difference between impairment testing and based on plans and so on. I agree with what Martin said, but our proposals on the business combination are not just linked to a plan. They're linked to the price the entity paid. So the entity paid $100 million. The entity had a whole pile of assumptions that justified it. Presumably, they weren't optimistic assumptions, and they really think the price should have been $80 million. So, you know, you're anchored to a transaction for our other disclosures. And that's the one thing I would say. This is a different discussion. The impairment testing relative to budgets, that's valid. That's what people have said is valid. The disclosures that we've advocated for this transaction, this massive important transaction, that's different. That's anchored to something very solid. And you should not expect management to be unduly optimistic in setting a price that they're paying to another party.
Yeah, good point. Okay, I think we can move on, unless there are further comments. We can move on.
Okay, so turning to agenda paper 18C, which is also unchanged from the equivalent paper for the April board meeting, other than a few minor editorial changes. And this paper deals with the board's preliminary view to retain the impairment-only model. Stakeholders' views remain mixed. Many respondents agreed with the board's preliminary view, but many other respondents disagreed, saying that amortization of goodwill should be reintroduced. The reasons provided by respondents were in two broad categories, conceptual reasons and practical reasons. And paragraphs 32 to 74 provide a summary of the arguments provided by those respondents in favour of reintroducing amortisation. And paragraphs 75 to 97 provide a summary of the arguments provided by those respondents in favour of retaining the impairment-only model. Respondents generally did not provide new conceptual arguments or evidence, although some respondents considered the limitations of the impairment test that have been identified to represent new practical evidence. A few respondents suggested approaches other than retaining the impairment-only model or reintroducing amortization, and these are summarised in paragraphs 98 to 107. And on convergence, although many respondents did not provide a response to this question, many respondents did, and most respondents who did comment said that convergence with US GAAP was desirable. However, many respondents said that their view did not depend on whether the outcome was consistent with US GAAP, or said the board should base its decision on the evidence it's collected rather than solely on maintaining convergence. And a summary of respondents' comments on convergence is included in paragraphs 117 to 123. So again, I'd like to open it up now to board members to discuss the feedback and whether board members have any questions or comments on the feedback.
Okay. Who's first? Jen Chow.
Thank you, Tim. I think it's also a very good paper. And I just have a couple of observations. First is about the relationship between improving the impairment test model and the introduced amortization. Because if I look at paragraph 29, some regulators, a few regulators and national standard setters suggest the board to improve the impairment test first, and then to decide whether we are going to introduce reintroduce amortization. So I think in the future, I think we should think about two things together. You know, I think there are different approaches. One approach is simply reintroduce amortization and without change anything about impairment test model. Another approach is improve the impairment test model first, and whether we can adjust too little, too late issue, and then to look at whether we're going to reintroduce amortization. Another thing is to consider together, but at least I think both methods should be considered together. But it's actually related to our board decision order, which we should decide first and next. So this is the first. Second, about reintroduce amortization, I particularly one of the arguments about how to determine, how to, you know, about the reliable estimate of user life, whether it could be made or not. And someone suggests that in order to determine the useful life, most of, I think, stakeholders suggest should be based on a management estimate. But how to rely on management estimate? I think the stakeholder proposed in the paragraph 46 is that depends on the estimate of synergies or benefits expected from acquisition. Well, that means the expected synergies and the benefits would be key to determine the useful life, or to help or to develop the model based on the management estimate. So this argument is actually related to our proposed disclosure, because one of our disclosure we propose in our discussion paper is to require entity to disclose the synergies, after the acquisition date. And there are a lot of arguments said that actually in practice, sometimes it's difficult to disclose that, difficult to estimate the synergies. So I also hope that when we think about this argument, I think this is the key, whether we really can reliably to estimate the useful life. And this is the key, we think about the feasible of the estimation of the synergies together, because it's related to our disclosure of synergies. So this is the second observation I would like to mention. The third one is about other reasons in relation to the reintroduced amortization. That is argument included in paragraph 54, because some stakeholders think that reintroduced amortization could well. Actually, they think that it is consistent with accounting for other tangibles and intangibles assets. But I think this argument we should be very careful to consider, because I think that if we look at the nature of goodwill, I think it's particularly different from tangibles assets and most of intangible assets, particularly those intangible assets with a limited use of life. But I think for goodwill, it's actually very close if you look at the nature of the goodwill, very close to the intangible assets with indefinite useful life. So another thing I think we should think about that if we are going to reintroduce amortization, so we are going, whether we reintroduce amortization of goodwill, whether we needed to relook at accounting treatment of intangible assets with indefinite use of life, because at this moment, for those intangible assets with indefinite use of life, actually we are also not required to amortize them. So this is third point I would like to, a third observation I would like to mention. That's all. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Jen Chow. Bruce?
Thanks very much, Hans. I think this paper is a great summary of the arguments on both sides, and I fear that we will not be the last board to discuss this question. I would bet in 10 years' time or 15 years' time it'll come back again, because the reality is there don't seem to be any new conceptual arguments to when this was originally amortization back to impairment, and we could move again, who knows. And to me, that's kind of the challenge of where we sit at the moment, is nobody's come out with that magical answer that says to me, okay, we've got to go one way or the other. What it's really going to come down to is what people's views are. My view, very simply, I genuinely believe goodwill is a wasting asset. To me, unlike what Jin Chao was saying, I actually think it's very akin to intangible assets. I think that when you purchase something, you've got an intangible and it wastes. Now, there will be many people on this board who feel the opposite way and will go the other way. And I think the challenge we're going to have is kind of weigh those up, which is why when I start getting into the things outside of that, I think to us the big issue is going to be, well, what are the other factors outside of those conceptual arguments we need to think about? Because I don't think we're going to get a new magical answer in terms of that. So I think, and I think the other problem, of course, is that when we look at the feedback, it wasn't as if it was all the preparers versus all the users or all the auditors. It was mixed kind of across the board. So we're really seeing this as a kind of across the board split. I say almost down the line, there's a bit more, but the key thing is that we're there. I do think that what we need to consider going forward is what are those things that add to the discussion. Things like, first and foremost, I think the US GAAP question is very important. We've heard from people, both from stakeholders, from us as well as other organizations, there is a desire to converge. And whereas I do agree that we should never be driven by that, I think it's a factor we need to consider on the basis that we don't have other conceptual arguments to drive us one way or the other. So I think it's those other factors. I think it's the usefulness of the tests. I think those are the kind of things that say, well, can we simplify the impairment test to a stage where we think we've met some of the objectives? If we hadn't, well, then wouldn't amortization work better for us? I'm not too worried, and I know a lot of people's arguments against amortization is this question of useful life. That doesn't worry me too much. And I come back once again to that word that I love, and that is in judgment. We use so much judgment on the impairment side that if we now go on amortization side, there's a judgment around the useful life. Well, we accept that. We make those kind of judgments all the way through IFRS, and those can change. And I actually think that a change in the useful life would be a lot easier for management to explain in terms of saying, well, yes, so we started off with 10 years or 15 years, and now we've reduced it or we've increased it, depending on how we're utilizing that asset. And I think, to me, that would be a bit more justifiable. I guess the message I'll be giving to the staff and going forward is I do think we're going to need to look quite closely at those things outside of the conceptual arguments, because unless somebody else has got a massive kind of silver bullet to take us one way or the other, I'm not convinced after even a week of debating we're going to kind of have found that perfect answer to this.
Anne?
Thanks, Hans. I wanted to make some of the same points that Bruce has made, in the sense that great paper, thanks staff, lots and lots of feedback, but the feedback doesn't really help us because it's so diverse and so divided. And, you know, we asked for conceptual arguments. We got a lot of people telling us they're giving us conceptual arguments and they're giving us practical arguments. And if you line them up in a table, you can make them spin both ways. You know, there's people that say we have to that it is a wasting asset. It's not a wasting asset. We have to amortize. We don't have to amortize. But they can be just taken every way. So in getting all this feedback, it's very useful, but it also makes the job very hard. So all of us are going to try and identify the things on which we think the decision turns. So for me, for example, I think the decision turns on what brings useful information to the users of the financial statements. But everyone's going to have their view. So I do appreciate looking forward to paper 18G that the staff have said we need to look at things together and decide the way forward, decide on how we want to proceed, because we are not getting a clear steer from the feedback. In fact, we're getting a very confused set of feedback that we need to work with. And I do think we have to recognise that, you know, we've now got a lot of feedback on the impairment test that didn't exist at the time, 10 years ago, at the time the board made the decision for the impairment-only model. And I think that will bear on the decision-making. But nevertheless, I still think that we have to think about usefulness of information, which is one of our objectives in doing this and why we spent so much time looking at disclosures. So I think the way forward is what we're going to discuss in 18G, trying to decide how we're going to proceed in this project and which things we need to look at and how to find a way forward through a mass of information. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Vika.
Yes, thank you, Hans. Thank you, staff, for paper. I will comment on a little bit about the convergence. I think both board have different stakeholders in the different environment. So each board has to respond, consider and respond to the need of the different stakeholders to adapt their environment. That said, we should consider the potential consequence of the situation in which two board choose different approaches, how that affect the global market and stakeholders we have. So I did a small outreach to Japanese stakeholder and so on. And for the usefulness and the comparability perspective, maybe the information about the profit loss type or discounted cash flow information is relatively easier to adjust to bridging to approach, while the information relating to the balance sheet it need to be improved if we need to bridge two approaches. And another thing is whether we can provide a stable platform in accounting treatment in connection with the goodwill second subsequent measurement. I think this accounting topic is really the most popular and probably the most contentious in the global market. So everybody know this issue and everybody like to talk about this one. So the relevant existence of the two approaches in the global market can invite the potential risk that the stakeholder always reclaim about the argument of the different approach. So I think we need a compelling basis for the board conclusion, whichever the direction we take in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Rika. Nick.
Thanks, Hans. Looking at the feedback and having participated in a lot of the outreach as well, I think the conclusion that I've reached in terms of the subsequent accounting for goodwill and the conceptual arguments is that these positions just aren't reconcilable. I just don't see either side moving on this. We've asked for new arguments. There aren't really any new arguments. What we have are a series of entrenched positions, and I think it will be very difficult conceptually to find a way forward, to find a compromise position. Perhaps that means a degree of pragmatism will be required going forward. Just a second comment I'd like to pick out from this paper. There's a comment about concerns about high goodwill balances. And again, I think that's a slightly emotive comment to me, perhaps a concern more within the accounting profession, certainly than within amongst investors. And I struggle to see how Highgood will balances actually have any direct threat to economic growth or economic stability. As far as I'm aware, the goodwill on an entity's balance sheet doesn't impact lending decisions. The lender will ignore that. I don't think it impacts a great deal of equity analysis as well. And that takes me to the comment in paragraph 73, which is attributed to a national standard setter, which says, you know, encouraging better capital allocation by providing useful information is the better way to achieve financial stability. And so, again, this takes me back to those set of disclosures, really. We are very much focused. Many of our stakeholders want us to focus on the technical arguments around how to treat goodwill and subsequent accounting for goodwill. And yes, that's important. But actually having a better understanding of terms of what a company has paid for an acquisition and giving information that will allow them to investors to judge the likely return on that acquisition, whether that's been successful or not, is what will drive more effective capital allocation and financial stability. Thank you.
Tadeu.
Thank you, Hans. Well, I agree with the preliminary view that it's not possible to design an impairment test that is significantly more effective. And this is also the position of most respondents. And said that, what I think that we have a problem and leave as it is not a solution. And I did not see, and then I will repeat this, leave as it is not a solution. And I did not see from those in favor of keeping the impairment-only model compelling evidence that this is working. Actually, in my view, it's the opposite way. It's not working. And I think this is a very important and strong argument. It's not working. It's very simple. Because of this, I agree also with Jin Chao that this is not just a matter of reintroducing or not reintroducing amortization. We have to put this together with the fact that we have to think about the useful life. I think that you have to think about, considering that is a wasting asset, thinking about whether the impairment test, the annual impairment test, should be retained even if we reintroduce amortization, or just in the first years or something like that. I mean, that it has to be a more holistic solution, but definitely just to make my point here that the point is that it's not working. We have a problem, and I think that just keeping as it is not a solution. Thank you.
Mary?
Comments both in response to the paper and to some of the comments made by other board members. One, in some ways, relates to one of Tadeo's comments, is I think we have all had an assumption in that if we talk about reconsidering and reintroducing amortization of goodwill, that it isn't an amortization-only model. It's an amortization plus impairment as a backstop, even with amortization. And secondly, going back to Jen Zhao's point, that if we reconsider the accounting for subsequent accounting for goodwill, we also would reconsider the subsequent accounting for indefinite-lived intangibles. And it may be worth starting to articulate those assumptions rather than just have them kind of, it's an assumption on my part, maybe I'm wrong, but I think unless we go the route that Tadeo was just suggesting of more fundamentally reconsidering application of impairment even in an amortization model, then I think we should get that assumption out there, both for expectations management and because it affects the basis of our analysis. And what I mean by affects the basis of our analysis is if even in an amortization model, there is an impairment backstop, it means that all the cost issues, you know, the direct cost issues that people are citing as part of the barriers still will exist. The real cost savings is the amount of pressure put on the judgments, the documentation, the process. It's not the actual cost of doing the test. And I think in some ways we have to think about whether that extra pressure, extra scrutiny is helpful or harmful in terms of holding entities to account. And it's an oversimplification to say that amortization would reduce the costs if we are intending to keep an impairment test that is the same impairment test that would apply if there weren't amortization. So I think when we're doing cost-benefit assessments that we need to have a lot of discipline in terms of putting our finger on what is the cost that we would or would not be saving. And it would be, to me, pressure rather than the actual cost of the performance. That's one thing. Second is, Bruce said, and I think it's always a good reminder not to be afraid of judgment and requiring preparers to apply judgment. And I think some of the discussion in paragraph 43 to 45 of this paper arguments we heard that people think that judgment can be exercised to determine a useful life for goodwill. And the irony is, I in an amortization setting, my concern is not about people who want to apply judgment. My concern is about people who say it will be too costly to apply judgment. I don't want to have to apply judgment. I want a safe harbor of a rebuttable presumption or an absolute limit, because that will save me having to justify the life. So I'm not, my concern is less about requiring the application of judgment and more about giving relief from the application of judgment, because I think that goes back to something that Anne raised, which is a further degradation in the usefulness of the information that's produced. And then to kind of fits in with both Anne and Bruce's point about evidence and how we weigh things if there's kind of an intractable conceptual standoff. I think it could be very helpful as we go forward to take the rich information that's in the review of academic evidence and try to integrate that on a kind of subject by subject, as you do further analysis of the issues that are recapped in this paper, because I think bringing those together could be quite useful. And then the last thing I was going to comment on is just going back to something Nick also touched on, which is the argument that goodwill is too high, and that's evidence that we need to reconsider impairment only. I think it's very important to put comments like that in context, and certainly the last 15 to 20 years, most of which have been accounted for under IFRS 3, have had a huge, huge amount of consolidation, roll-ups of companies, a very high level of M&A activity, and, driven by economics of transactions rather than by accounting advantages or desired outcomes. And in that, and I have heard in outreach meetings, I remember one very large pension fund manager complaining that the number of options he had in terms of where to invest his money had shrunk tremendously in terms of the number of players because of the degree of consolidation. And in that context, a significant increase in goodwill doesn't strike me as surprising or indicative of an accounting problem. So I just wanted to remind us to think about things in context. So state what our assumptions are, try and integrate the academic evidence as we go forward, and think hard about the logic in terms of cost savings. I think the cost savings is about pressure and scrutiny. It's not about the cost of providing of performing the calculations if we're going to keep them as a backstop. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. Martin?
Yeah, thanks, Hansmann. I found really interesting what is stated in paragraphs 108, user views, because my understanding prior to that feedback was always that users would prefer the impairment-only approach because of the information value that is higher than the amortization approach. But on that feedback is that many users would favor an reintroduction of amortization, but also many would favor stay on the impairment-only model. But that was really new information to me, because I was always, and also many other people said, okay, it is users want to have a kind of impairment-only and would not like to have amortization, but that is not true based on that feedback. That is one observation which I find very, very interesting. Secondly, okay, that some people say they are not concerned if goodwill balances are increasing. I'm also not concerned about increasing goodwill balances. But the problem is, if some people and many people think that, okay, the impairment test is not very effective, and then if we have high goodwill balances, that would be a problem. Maybe it's not a problem for professional investors, but we have also users which are not so professional, and we have kind of also other interested parties in accounting and in the financial statements. And we all know that the goodwill balance, which is very high, but maybe should be impaired, has an impact on equity. And we have seen in many, many, many cases when companies go bust with high goodwill balances, that we have from many people, maybe not professional users, but from other people saying, okay, how could come? Because they had good equity, high number of equity number, and then they go bust. And that is really my concern. And if we not able to improve the effectiveness of the impairment test, I'm concerned with high goodwill balances. Because there are cases where then if companies get in trouble, then it is really a big problem. If they have high goodwill, which has an impact on equity, and then okay, people, many people think, okay, it is a kind of covering of liabilities than others, maybe not sophisticated, but politicians, other people are doing that. And then we have
journalists, many journalists.
Journalists and my
in the sophisticated
and I will not decide on this because I'm not any longer board member, but I think it is for me, it is a kind of in this feedback, we have new information, and new information is especially what I see in 108 user views. And I think the linkage, and I have said it from the beginning of the progress for project, the linkage for me is okay if, and that was also from the post-implementation review, if many people think, okay, there is a problem with effectiveness, and we have high goodwill balances, there is an issue. And if we cannot solve it with a better effectiveness of impairment test, maybe alternative is go back to amortization. That is what I have also. I think when we drafted the discussion paper. Thanks.
Sue.
Thanks, Hans. The thing that amazes me most when I read these papers is the strength of opinion and the certainty that people have that they know what the right conceptual answer is. Because the only thing I know for certain after this journey that we've been on is that I can see both points of view and I can see arguments in both directions. And all I know for sure is that, you know, the impairment model is imperfect. We know that. We acknowledge that. We know that it's a noisy analysis. But on the flip side, I know for sure that I'm not going to be convinced that just amortizing over a fixed period of X number of years in every situation is going to provide useful information to users of financial statements. And so for me, I have to say I echo very much what Anne said. When I look at this issue with all of this feedback, there's different points of view. There's lots of interesting points raised by people. But we're going to have to look for the best package of decisions that we can come up with, looking at the subsequent accounting for goodwill, as far as I'm concerned, along with the disclosure ideas that we've been investigating. What package of information provides the best balance and provides useful information to investors? because at the end of the day, we're having a heated conceptual debate about something which is largely an accounting concept. We need to get back to the heart of the issue, which is what information helps investors assess the success of acquisitions and provides useful information. So I'll be very interested to that's how I'll be coming at it, Tim and staff, in terms of how I'll be thinking about it, because I don't think there's a right answer that I'm going to fight to the death for. There's differences of view.
Tom?
Yeah, just a couple of small comments. With respect especially to what we do with the, if we do think about changing goodwill to amortization, what we do with the other intangibles. And one of the things I actually disagree. I think you could conceptually do something that would be conceptually more correct. And I think there's a lot of evidence based in the last go round, especially when you read the basis for conclusions last time, the paragraphs BC313, et cetera, where they tried to decompose goodwill. And I think if you did try to get something that really was conceptually sound, almost inevitably you need to go back and read those paragraphs and start decomposing goodwill. I'm not saying we should. I'm merely saying that that is a possibility, but I doubt it would pass a cost-benefit trade-off in the sense that we could come up with something that's conceptually sounder, but probably at a prohibitive cost and almost impossible to sell. It is relevant a little bit, though, if we are going to take another look at these other intangibles, because in that basis, they said that it was really only the going concern and the synergies that were conceptually properly part of goodwill. And they said sort of increases in the value of the existing assets when you brought them on, and adding all those missing intangibles. The missing intangibles weren't goodwill, they were just missing intangibles. I think conceptually they're quite different. So if we do go to look at it, I do think we should think about what these things are conceptually. In that debate, there was a huge one over the assembled workforce. So a lot of things like brands and so got moved out to missing intangibles. There was a huge debate on taking assembled workforce out, and they decided it didn't meet the definition of an asset, so it got left into goodwill. But I would think conceptually, if we took a hard look at an assembled workforce versus a synergy and thought about what those represent economically, those are somewhat different things. So I don't totally buy that you can't go and study these things. And I do think if we're going to do something with intangibles, we should think hard about, go back and read exactly what they said and think about what are the differences then between what we have in goodwill versus what we took out. So as we go forward and try and sort it in the sense that it is going to be very hard to come up with a thing that satisfies everyone, because as several people have pointed out, people have hard positions and they're not going to be easily moved off them. And there's also, even in the wasting asset issue. I think I would argue ultimately that synergies are probably a wasting asset to the degree that they're abnormal returns. And most economics would argue that abnormal returns cannot be kept on indefinitely. Some people might disagree. But the if one stopped, a lot of the arguments for impairment that the users make isn't, I would argue the wasting asset is a representational faithfulness concern. In other words, if you leave goodwill there forever, you're not being representationally faithful because it's a wasting asset, so it needs to go. On the other hand, a lot of the users who really like the impairment model argue from an informational perspective. And our two biggest characteristics are relevance and representational faithfulness. And to some degree, in the case of goodwill, these things are a little bit offset against each other, because a lot of people say the disclosures attached to the impairment test are critical. We get, and there's a whole series of good paragraphs in the document. So that's also something to think about, is we actually have, I think, a competing vision about what should dominate. If it's wasting asset, it's kind of representational faithfulness dominating. If it's impairment, a lot of the arguments are based on useful information that comes out of the disclosures. And again, those are things that we could pursue and think about. And so again, just kind of going forward, I think we need to take everyone's and try and go back and be as evidence-based, and where we can find some good concepts to anchor on, we should grab them.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Dan Chao.
Thank you, Hans. Just two additional comments. Firstly, that coming back to the first point I made before about the relationship between reintroduced amortization and improving the effectiveness of impairment model. As Dadu said, that there is evidence currently available that existing impairment model, you know, didn't work very well. So what? How can we do it? Simply, we just reintroduce amortization of goodwill, or leave impairment model alone. So that's leave all those issues keep there and do not do anything. From my point of view, regardless whether we are going to reintroduce amortization, I think we need to do something to improve the impairment model of particularly relating to the goodwill. Clearly, there are issues there. I think there are some very good suggestions there. We can borrow those ideas to help us to improve impairment law model, particularly if in the end you introduce amortization as Mary said, as a backstop. I think in the end we still will keep impairment model in place for goodwill. So what kind of impairment model we should have? I think we should take this opportunity to improve that a little bit. Secondly, about what kind of objective of subsequent measurement of goodwill. I agree with what Anne mentioned and also Sue mentioned again about in the end, what we are going to do is provide useful information to the users. Obviously, users has different views. It's no problem. I think some support impairment only models, some support to reintroduce amortization. It's good, but we need to double check what kind of information they really want. And the second, even we are going to reintroduce amortization, the model, for example, how to determine the useful life and what kind of estimate assumption they are using and what kind of information we are going to provide. I think we still should bear in mind the usefulness of information, even based on amortization, should be the highest priority. What I worry about is that we end up that simply just want to get rid of, you know, goodwill from balance sheet based on reintroducing goodwill. And then people will argue why we need to recognize goodwill at the initial, you know, at the acquisition date, because in the end, subsequently, you just get rid of that amount from balance sheet. So usefulness of that information, amortization, should be also be the first priority or first criteria, even we decided to reintroduce amortization. So just the balance, but I think in usefulness of the information still should be our key objective if we are going to develop further model. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dan Chao. Well, now that we have solved this issue, shall we take a 5 minutes break? And return in 5 minutes for the final papers? Okay.